From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Attorney General Maura Healey alleges Purdue Pharma, owned by the Sackler family, used aggressive business practices that contributed to opioid deaths.
The complaint even alleges that staff told the Sacklers that tens of thousands of deaths were just going to be the tip of the iceberg, and that for every death, there was going to be more than 100 people suffering from prescription dependency or abuse.
Also today, Senator Ed Markey on the latest from Washington.
I think the president should focus not on writing a State of the Union address. He should focus on negotiating the reopening of the federal government.
And Gillette invokes the Me Too movement in a new ad, sparking a backlash.
Bullying.
The Me Too movement against sexual
toxic
harassment.
Masculinity.
Is this the best a man can get?
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. In just a few minutes, we'll have more on a new memo from Attorney General Maura Healey. She alleges that the Sackler family, who's behind Purdue Pharma, aggressively pushed the painkiller OxyContin even after family members were told by employees that overdose deaths tripled due to opioids. But first, we turn to Washington, D.C., where House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is asking President Trump to delay his State of the Union speech set for January 29th until the government shutdown is over. We're now in day 26 of that shutdown, with no deal to reopen the government in the works. We reached Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey at the Capitol a few minutes ago to ask about developments there. And I started by asking him if he agrees with Speaker Pelosi that the speech should be put off.
I do agree that the speech should be put off. We are right now in a situation where the president cannot report to the nation that we are strong as a nation. We have a government which is shut down. We have individuals who work for the federal government all across the country who protect the safety, the health of Americans, and they right now are sitting at home. So I think the president should focus not on writing a State of the Union address. He should focus on negotiating the reopening of the federal government.
We're now 26 days into this government shutdown, and we recently spoke with Emily Kelleher. She's an attorney with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and she says she took out loans for college and law school like many people do, and now that she's not being paid, she's really struggling to find money to both pay her loans and her rent and bills. Let's hear from her.
It's extremely frustrating that I see it that I worked very hard and I, you know, borrowed a lot of money from the federal government, which they want back despite, you know, the shutdown every month. And I wanted to do public interest work and I wanted the security of the job. I'm trying to do good work and worked very hard, and we're just, you know, we're not able to work and we're being instructed to do things like take up carpentry or babysit. So it's a little insulting, I would say.
Senator, how can people trust that their government still works for them and that it will work again in the future?
I think Emily hit it right on the head. Emily has been furloughed from working for the federal government, but she cannot furlough her student loan payments. Other families can't furlough their mortgage payments, their car payments. If they're not receiving a check, then they are under enormous stress with the real world problems that just keep coming at them, but without the money to be able to deal with them. So that's President Trump's problem. He doesn't really understand what the real world human impact is on ordinary families, ordinary people like Emily. And that's why we just have to reopen the government and then negotiate on security at our border. We just can't do it the other way.
But Senator, I have to ask, you know, the federal government expects to spend $4 trillion this fiscal year. Compared to that, $5 billion is a tiny fraction. I mean, it's not even 1%. So a question for Democrats is, you know, why not give the president that money to alleviate people like Emily in this difficult situation right now, and maybe even bargain for a new deal on, say, immigration to reopen the government?
Well, because if we give in to President Trump's temper tantrum right now, he'll just do it again when we hit the debt ceiling. He'll do it again when we hit the next deadline. And he'll just do this over and over and over again. So the Republican paradox is they don't believe in the government, but they have to run for office in order to make sure it doesn't work. That's what Donald Trump is doing right now. Over and over again, we've had Republicans, you know, vote to reopen the government. Those proposals are just turning the Republicans inside out, because now their position is that they won't support anything that Donald Trump won't sign, even though many of them support legislation that would reopen the government. And if we allow this precedent to be set, then Donald Trump is just going to turn our federal employees into one big pawn in a game which he wants to play, which is something that ultimately demeans the service of all of these people across Massachusetts and the country.
Hmm. Senator, I want to touch on another issue that really hits close to home here. People in the Merrimack Valley are receiving backdated bills. These are their first bills since the explosions and fires in September that impacted hundreds of homes and killed one person. You wrote a letter to Columbia Gas and its parent company yesterday flagging two issues that affected residents are getting a winter rate increase, and that people not directly impacted but had their gas shut off after the disaster are receiving large bills this January with January due dates. Do you see any signal from Columbia that they'll consider easing either of these billing requirements?
No, thank you. That's a great question. You know, I put together this letter with Senator Warren and Congressman Seth Moulton and Laurie Trahan. And the goal is just to ask Columbia Gas why customers impacted by the Merrimack Valley natural gas explosions and fires were receiving these large backdated bills with due dates in January after the company assured that they would not do so. And so while Columbia Gas is now apologizing for its lack of communication with residents about the backdated bills, it still has no commitment to suspend that planned rate increase of 1.5% that they are intending on imposing on the residents of Merrimack Valley. That is just completely unacceptable, and we are going to make sure that we keep a spotlight on them until they rescind that absurd additional penalty on these people who have suffered from the incompetence of Columbia Gas.
You know, Columbia did send us a response highlighting that the winter rate increase happens every year, as you said, it's planned, and that it was already approved by the state. And they are a utility. They do need to provide gas. Is it so out of line to go forward with what they call a normal rate increase to cover the increased cost of service?
They may think that it's a normal rate increase, but it's within an abnormal circumstance. These people have been victimized by the incompetence, by the negligence of Columbia Gas, and it's absurd that this company then thinks that it can, during this winter period, put an extra assessment upon these people. The families in Merrimack Valley are already stretching their budgets to cover holiday expenses, higher bills, unexpected costs that can be hundreds of dollars, thousands of dollars to the family. And here we have yet an additional unwelcome surprise that goes into the lives of all these people. Columbia Gas should just be be big about this. Put on the big boy pants and just say they are not going to impose this additional burden on these poor families that have already suffered too much.
And Senator, moving on here, you and other members of the Environment and Public Works Committee have been hearing testimony from Andrew Wheeler today, President Trump's nominee to head the EPA and a former coal lobbyist. And he said today that he would, quote, not call global climate change the greatest crisis. He does say it's, quote, a huge issue that has to be addressed globally. Senator, your reaction to that?
Well, again, Andrew Wheeler was a lobbyist for the coal industry, and Donald Trump has absurdly named a coal lobbyist as the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. We might as well rename it Every Polluter's Ally. That's how absurd it is. And so to the extent to which the man in charge of dealing with climate change doesn't really see it as a climate crisis is in and of itself a statement that disqualifies him for the job of being the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. And that's what I said to him in the confirmation hearing today.
Let's talk about the confirmation hearings for President Trump's pick for Attorney General William Barr. One of the Attorney General's responsibilities would be, of course, to oversee the special counsel's probe into whether the Russian government interfered with the presidential election and whether the president tried to aid that effort. Barr wrote this long, unsolicited memo to the president's legal team over the summer, arguing that an obstruction of justice case against the president would be weak. Could he be impartial then, overseeing Mueller's investigation? How would you vote if his confirmation is advanced?
I don't think that William Barr can be impartial. I am going to vote no on his confirmation. We need someone who is going to be absolutely, from an appearances perspective, completely impartial in evaluating the Mueller report, evaluating all of the charges that could potentially come against the president. Right now, we have a nominee who has already indicated a pre-existing bias against this investigation and, as a result, should not be allowed to serve in America's highest law enforcement office.
Senator, I want to ask you about something that a lot of Massachusetts residents are thinking about today, a dramatic development in the opioid epidemic story here in Massachusetts. Attorney General Maura Healey filed a memorandum in court alleging that the Sackler family, who's behind Purdue Pharma, flooded the state with sales reps and that they influenced state legislation and financially backed medical facilities and universities so that they could tout the opioid produced by Purdue. Are you following this story? What's your reaction?
Well, the original sin of this opioid epidemic is the approval by the FDA in 1996 of the Sackler family petition to the FDA that OxyContin was, in fact, not a dangerous medicine for Americans to be taken. Purdue Pharma turned our nation into the United States of OxyContin. That's the reality of it, and that company and that family must be made accountable for what they did to hundreds of thousands or millions of other families in our country.
That's Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey. Senator Markey, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you. You're welcome.
We want to stay with this opioid story. As we've reported, there were more than 2,000 opioid-related deaths in Massachusetts in 2017. That out of 72,000 deaths nationwide. In a new memo, as we've been telling you, Attorney General Maura Healey alleges that the Sackler family, which owns OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma, aggressively pushed the painkiller in the state even after employees told higher-ups that overdose deaths had tripled due to opioids. WBUR's senior investigative reporter and editor, Christine Wilmson, has been following the story, and she joins us now. Christine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Maria.
So what are we learning from the documents Attorney General Healey filed yesterday about Purdue Pharma? What new information does she allege?
In this new version of this memo, she really details how the Sackler family knew that the OxyContin drugs were a danger to people, but that they were still cashing in.
Hmm. So how specifically did the company target people in Massachusetts?
For instance, one sales rep was ordered to increase prescriptions by 62% in our state. Purdue even threatened to fire two reps in Massachusetts because physicians hadn't been visited enough and they hadn't written enough prescriptions. The sales vice president at the time was drafting emails to the Boston district. This was in February 2012 and said basically, Boston district is failing. The sales manager agreed in an email, and they discussed firing every single rep, saying it would send the perfect or send the right message. One of the things to keep in mind is that the staff said to the Purdue Pharma, as well as the Sacklers in 2013, that drug overdoses were increasing and, in fact, had tripled since 1990, while OxyContin had actually become the top-selling painkiller in the country. The complaint even alleges that staff told the Sacklers that tens of thousands of deaths were just going to be the tip of the iceberg, and that for every death, there was going to be more than 100 people suffering from prescription dependency or abuse.
So tell me about the Sacklers. Eight of them were implicated in this case. What do we know about the family?
Emails, notes, board meetings really detail how each Sackler was obsessed with profits, specifically the board director, the chairman himself, Richard Sackler. He was known as a micromanager. He was obsessed with sales. He even went across the country visiting sales representatives, complaining about advertising, complaining that they weren't meeting expectations.
Hmm. Now, Purdue Pharma claims that Healey is trying to vilify them. Tell me about their response.
Purdue Pharma claims that basically Healey is cherry-picking some of the facts. In reality, they say that their medicines only represent 2% of opioid pain prescriptions out there and that the real problem is illegal heroin and fentanyl on the streets.
Well, and they say that Healey is conflating those illegal drugs on the streets with the results from prescription opioids, right?
Yeah, they're saying that basically her numbers are wrong and that the number of deaths are not nearly as high as what Healey alleges.
So what's the backdrop or the context that surrounds Purdue Pharma and these filings? In other words, do we know the extent to which Purdue knew pushing OxyContin was contributing to the opioid crisis?
Part of the memo details some interesting information in 2013 in which staff actually went to the Sacklers as well as the board and told them that basically there were so many drug overdoses that it had tripled since 1990. And this was at the same time as OxyContin became one of those top-selling drugs in the country.
So what larger questions does this case raise about Big Pharma and accountability?
I think people are going to be wondering, can you sue a family or the people behind a corporation for something so dangerous as this that has led to thousands of deaths across the country?
So these kinds of revelations, I think, remind so many people of the beginning of the end for Big Tobacco going back 70 years ago. Do you see oversight and regulations coming down the line?
That's something that we're definitely going to be looking into. I think some states have started with legislation. It's really unclear at this point if the government will step up and take a bigger bite of this and make a bigger impact.
Do these filings mean anything yet for people whose loved ones died of OxyContin overdoses?
I'm sure to some degree that this brings up some wounds for some of these families, but I think some are also hoping that this brings them closure. And if there is a settlement, my understanding is that some of that money will go towards prevention.
So you're still reporting on this story, obviously. What questions do you still have and what next are you following?
Well, there's so many questions because there's such detailed information in here that spelled out the impact and influence that the family had on legislation here in Massachusetts. So we'll be taking a look at their influence on government legislation in our state. And we'll also be taking a look at other parts of the philanthropic side of the Sackler family and the amount of money they gave to universities and facilities across the state.
All right, that's Christine Wilmson, WBUR Senior Investigative Reporter and Editor. Christine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how a Sri Lankan refugee in Boston used cricket to reconnect with his roots. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Greater Boston is home to the fifth largest Sri Lankan community in the United States. The island is now emerging from nearly 30 years of war, but it's still plagued by political instability. This is a story of how one man reconnected to his native country through cricket. WBUR's Walter Wuthman has more.
My name is Inpachelvin Vithyanandan. I go by Chevy here.
Chevy Vithyanandan is from Sri Lanka, the small island nation off the coast of India. He grew up under the shade of coconut palms, going to school, doing chores, getting in trouble, but mostly playing cricket. In Sri Lanka, cricket is not just a sport. It's an obsession that borders on religious devotion.
If the national team is playing a cricket game, the whole country shuts down. Because everybody's either listening it on the radio in my days or probably watching it on TV these days. Nobody pays any attention to anything else.
Chevy says he still has the calluses on his hands today that he got on the cricket pitch as a kid at school.
We play it before school starts, and then we have a lunch break, which is like 45 minutes. And most of us bring sandwiches. We'll probably finish eating before even lunch starts. And, you know, you run into the field to try and secure a spot to play cricket.
But in high school, things began to change. It was 1983, and ethnic tensions in Sri Lanka were high. In the decades since independence from the British, the government had passed discriminatory laws favoring the Sinhalese majority over the Tamil minority. By the 1980s, young Tamils were forming armed groups. They wanted their own separate state. Chevy is Tamil, and as a teenage boy growing up in the dusty northern town of Jaffna, he was the perfect target for recruitment by the guerrillas.
And they would come into the schools and will, you know, distribute pamphlets and you know, you saw guns.
Chevy had to navigate a treacherous world. On one side were the Tamil militias, and on the other, the military.
You don't have to be involved in anything. It's just by the fact that you're an 18-year-old boy was not a good thing.
In July of 83, a young militant group known as the Tamil Tigers attacked an army convoy. Almost immediately afterwards, massive retaliatory riots consumed Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo. The riots went on for a week. By the end, Sinhalese mobs had killed an estimated 3,000 Tamil civilians and burned whole neighborhoods to the ground.
That's when I realized I need to get out.
Chevy had been to upstate New York as an exchange student. He knew he needed to leave again, so he applied to the State University of New York and got accepted. A family agreed to host him. So even as the ashes in Colombo were cooling, Chevy boarded a plane to the United States. He had no idea how long he'd be away from home.
First time I arrived was in August, towards the end of August. I was wearing jeans, I was wearing two T-shirts and a jean jacket, and I was cold. Must have been in the 70s.
The weather was different, the food was different. Gone were the chilies and cinnamon and cardamom of Sri Lankan curries. Instead, there was spaghetti and casserole.
My first few weeks, it probably made my host mother very upset because I needed hot sauce on everything she prepared, and I'm pretty sure she wasn't very happy with that.
But what Chevy says he missed most was cricket. His new home in America was full of baseball diamonds and football fields, but no cricket pitches. To fill the void, he initially tried out for football, which is how he got his nickname.
Back home, they called me Chelvin. So when I came here, I went by Chelvin. But my first week or second week here, school starts, and I said, I want to play football. So I went to go football practice, And the coach asked me what my name was, and I said, Chelvin. He goes, Chevy. That was it. Since then, I've been Chevy.
Chevy played football and then softball, but he says it didn't feel the same. Back home, the war raged on.
Malaysia's longest-running war has torn apart the country, with civilians caught in the middle, desperately trying to fend for themselves.
The bloody aftermath of a suicide attack on a security checkpoint in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo.
Time is now running out for the Tamil Tigers. The Sri Lankan government has given them till noon on Tuesday to surrender or face further military action.
Years of conflict became decades. Chevy thought he'd never play his childhood game again. And he didn't for 30 years. In that time, he went to SUNY and then MIT and graduated with an engineering degree. He met his wife, they had two children, and settled in Burlington. He celebrated holidays with other Tamils in the Boston area. He watched the Patriots on Sundays, and he felt far away from home. Until one day, about 6 years ago.
One of the guys at one of the Tamil events said, hey, you know, we play cricket on Sundays.
It had been so long, Chevy says it felt foreign.
It took me almost 10 days of playing cricket before I could make contact with the bat and the ball, because it's the whole softball motion or the baseball motion is different from cricket. And I just kept missing every ball.
Sunday after Sunday, Chevy was out on the makeshift cricket pitch behind a school in Burlington. They'd play on a baseball diamond, one wicket at home plate and the other at second base. Chevy started getting closer with the guys he played with.
Even though, you know, our age differences, the stories are the same. The talk about cricket and the games and, you know, the high school rivalries are still there. And we still have those rivalries here. So it's who we were, you know, and the connection is still there.
The violence of the Sri Lankan Civil War has created diaspora communities all over the U.S. and Canada. Hungry for a connection to their lost homes, many, like Chevy, turned to cricket. Now there are whole tournaments of Tamil cricket teams.
Saturday early morning, the games start, and there will be breakfast served at the field, and it'll be a good Sri Lankan meal. In Sri Lanka, everything revolves around food as well. So lunch will be served, and it's all home-cooked dishes.
The game, the meals, the people, they connect Chevy to his past. By the time Chevy'd started playing cricket again, the war had ended. For the first time, he began to think seriously of moving back home. After the military left some of the former war zones, he visited Sri Lanka and returned to the house he grew up in.
There's bullet holes and, you know, windows missing and roof caved in and walls broken and so on and so forth. So it's hard to come to grips with it, you know, because that's where you grew up. But it was what it was. I mean, people had it worse.
Across the street, Chevy's uncle's house was in similar shape. Chevy fixed up the ruined house. He replaced the windows. He replaced the roof. He returned to Burlington and lobbied his wife to split their time. 6 months in the U.S., 6 months in Sri Lanka.
It's home. I don't know. I don't know how to describe it. It's home.
But still, things may not be safe for refugees to come home. 3 months ago, Sri Lanka's former wartime president, who's accused by the UN of presiding over massive war crimes against Tamils, staged an unsuccessful political coup. So Chevy is still watching and waiting. But at least, he says, he has cricket again.
How long do you see yourself playing?
It's a good question. As long as my body lets me.
That report from WBUR's Walter Withman. Stay with us, there's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. A new Gillette ad is giving some people a little razor burn.
Bullying.
The Me Too movement against sexual harassment.
Toxic masculinity.
Is this the best a man can get? We can't hide from it. It's been going on far too long. We can't laugh it off. Making the same old excuses.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys.
But something finally changed.
Allegations regarding sexual.
And there will be no going back.
The Boston-based Razor Company's ad called We Believe the Best Men Can Be tackles toxic masculinity by showing men engaging in behavior like bullying and sexual harassment, as well as being role models for better behavior. The ad poses the question, is this the best a man can get? While the ad is a sign of progress for some, others say it paints too broad a picture of masculinity and are calling for a boycott of the company. Joining us to talk about this is Boston Globe columnist and travel writer Chris Muther. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Well, really happy to have you here. Also, we're joined by Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham from the Boston Globe studio. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Maria.
Hi. And listeners, we also want to hear from you. What did you think of the ad? Did you appreciate Gillette taking a stance, or did the company go too far? Do you think Gillette should have used this social commentary for an advertisement? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right, let's get to the discussion here. Chris and Renee, initial reaction to the ad. We'll start with you, Chris.
My initial reaction was I was really taken aback to the point where I was almost moved to tears, which I wouldn't expect to have happened watching an ad for razors.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I was so moved by it was particularly the scenes on bullying really took me back to my days in junior high and high school when I hate to use the word victim, but I was a victim of bullying almost constantly through those years, to the point where I would come up with excuses not to go to school.
Hmm. Yeah. So you wrote in a piece that the bullying part really, really, really stuck with you. And you told me that you've received hundreds of emails today, people who can relate to your article.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
I mean, I've really been taken aback. I was expecting there would be a reaction. I didn't know what kind of a reaction, but there have been hundreds of emails, I'd say 99.9% positive. And a lot of them are from people who are saying they want the best for their children. They want their children to live in a world where they don't have to worry about bullying and sexism, those sorts of issues, and that they're excited to see this ad come along and sort of impart a message, even though it is just an ad for razors. They see it as something more. Some of the emails are from reformed bullies who are apologizing, saying, you know, if we had any idea our actions caused these sorts of implications further down the line, then we would have acted differently. And then some just people thanking me for being honest about my experiences.
Mm-hmm. Renee, what did you think of the ad?
I was really surprised because, you know, when this kind of thing happens, it can go horribly wrong. And I think of the Pepsi ad a few years ago with Kendall Jenner, which tried to, you know, use the Black Lives Matter movement to sell soda.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this wasn't that. You know, this isn't an ad where you constantly see a Gillette razor. This was taking a really broad view and a very poignant view of toxic masculinity, and we talk about it a lot. But here we were seeing all these examples, not just within the context of Me Too, but as Chris has mentioned, bullying and the effects that has on the people who are bullied. I mean, it was really sort of a remarkable thing for Gillette, I think, to take its tagline, you know, the best a man can get, and kind of turn it inside out into, you know, the best a man can be. And so taking it from a product to saying, you know, we need to talk about these issues. We need to bring these to the forefront and do something about them because they're deeply harming our society.
I want to take a phone call from Jeff from the South End. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how are you?
Well, thank you. What's your comment or your question?
My comment is toxic masculinity is a term that's been kind of rolled out by by feminists that kind of, I think, you know, put men into a box. If you just take the simple exercise of turning it around and saying, what if they ran an ad calling it toxic femininity and taking some of the unsavory aspects of the female gender that are out in the fringes and kind of rolled out an ad, the outrage would be explosive against that ad. And I'm starting to see some outrage regarding this ad, which I think is great. But taking the fringe elements of men are good. Masculinity is a good thing. But taking the fringe elements of masculinity and turning it into toxic masculinity, it's really terrible. And I think the outrage would be enormous if they ran a similar ad for Gillette's female razor calling it toxic femininity. We're talking about bullying. Girls in middle school are extremely aggressive in their social, relational bullying of other girls, and that is just as big a problem as it is for boys who bully. And that ad would never really play on a national stage.
All right, Jeff, thank you so much. Renee, I want to ask you about that. So what if we saw an ad with toxic femininity? Is that a fair equivalency for you?
I was really hoping he would define toxic femininity, because I don't quite know what that would look like. You know,
well, I mean, he talked about, you know, junior high girls and how much bullying there is among young girls in junior
kids
high.
Bully. Right. Kids do bully each other. That's, you know, beyond gender, kids do bully each other. But the commercial is, this ad is talking about something beyond that. It is talk about this idea of weakness in men. And, you know, it reminded me of, I think it was last couple of seasons ago, New York Giants wide receiver Odell Beckham was ridiculed because he cried on camera after he fractured his ankle during a football game. And, you know, the next day, and really the minutes after that, he was getting all this flack on social media that somehow he needed to man up, that was no way for him to behave. And I kept thinking, he fractured his ankle, which must hurt like bloody blue blazes, not to mention it pretty much ended his season. So, you know, this idea that somehow he was weak in doing that, well, I think that's the kind of thing that this ad is trying to counterbalance. You know, the idea that somehow, well, yes, we can do this about women too in the fringes, but the problem is no one said masculinity is bad. Toxic masculinity is bad.
Yeah. Chris, what do you think? What does the ad teach us about what we expect from men in society and how we've defined masculinity over time?
What I think is interesting, just to go back to the caller for a moment, because I've heard and read a lot of comments similar to his. And the idea of, I think someone emailed me one of my three negative emails and said, you know, if this were a tampon ad, no one would stand for it. There would be outrage. And I think reading so much into this ad is not the right way to look at it. I think looking at the ad, the basic message is let's set an example, a good example. And I think they showed men and boys and setting an example. And I think to take it further than that, I think to start looking at comparing it to women, comparing it to other groups isn't the right way to look at it. And then I feel if people are jumping in and they're defensive of that, then what is that saying about what their feelings are toward bullying, towards women? I realize that's reading a lot as well, but that was sort of my initial reaction because I've heard those comments a lot. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your initial question.
No, that's okay. Well, I do think this is a good time. I want to bring in another voice in the conversation. Matt McDonald is the editor of the New Boston Post, a conservative publication. He wrote about why he takes offense to the ad in his piece titled Gillette, the Best a Man Can Do Without. And he joins us on a cell phone. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Maria.
So tell me, why do you take issue with the advertisement?
The scene with the 2 6-year-old boys fighting in the backyard is disturbing to me. because if you look at a timeline of the ad is not presented in linear fashion, but if you try to create a timeline out of it and you go from back to front, you sign the beginning with older men looking in the mirror not liking what they see. And the implication is they don't like what they see because of the way they've behaved through life. And how they behaved through life? Well, as young men, perhaps they were physically assaulting young women, leering at young women, treating them in inappropriate fashion. Why is that? As teenagers, they were part of a gang chasing and bullying a weak individual. Why is that? Because as six-year-old boys, they're rolling around in their backyard fighting each other over some dispute. That is a part and parcel of how young boys develop. It's not destructive behavior for two boys to settle a dispute with their fists. And to present that as if masculinity is that, and it all comes back to the topic of toxic masculinity, I think that term by itself is a problem, because what it's saying is not that masculinity can be used in bad fashions. It's that masculine traits are themselves somehow destructive.
But Matt, isn't that painting too broad of a stroke to say that it's normal for little boys to sort of hash it out with violence at 5 or 6 years old? I mean, as a mother of a 4-year-old, I would find it really disturbing if I were to see my little boy physically fighting with another little boy. Aren't you generalizing too much?
I don't think so. Boys tend to fight it out sometimes. I'm not talking about situations where somebody's getting seriously injured. I'm certainly not talking about a gang ganging up on one person. But two boys settling a dispute by fighting it out is not destructive. It's part of how boys develop. That's how a boy actually learns to stand up for himself. And to say that that leads to these other bad behaviors, it's just not so.
Chris, you were a boy.
I was, yes.
What are you thinking about these comments?
I do think boys fight. That's true. And I think there are different levels of fighting. And I think, yes, sometimes disputes are solved that way. I think maybe a large part of the time, and I can only speak from experience, one of those boys necessarily doesn't want to be in that fight. One of the boys has been cornered into the fight. And if it's working out a dispute, that's not how a dispute is worked out. I think in this case, the dad or bystander who came over and sort of separated the boys knew that. He knew that that's a healthy way to do it. And again, the underlining theme behind it all is boys will be boys, and how that is slightly toxic to look at it that way, because we've been living with boys will be boys for so long. And this ad isn't going to make that go away. But again, I feel like the idea of using fighting as normal male development may not be the norm, and I definitely don't think it should be the norm.
All right. Well, we have so many phone calls. Let's go to Kristen from Salem. Hi, Kristen.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us what you think about this.
So I was actually in support of this ad. I am a teacher. I teach fifth grade, and so I constantly am surrounded by children, and I really like the way that this ad is trying to keep adults accountable for the way that they're acting, the way that they're speaking, because a lot of that does come into the classroom, and it's something that we are constantly dealing with, of reminding students that if you disagree with someone, that's fine, but you use your words, you express your ideas. You know, it doesn't need to come to violence.
All right, Kristen from Salem, thank you so much. So in addition to talking about bullying, which we've addressed, this ad also takes on the Me Too movement by showing scenarios where men are stepping in and saying, hey, it's not cool to catcall women or say things like, smile, sweetie. This is turning the conversation to men. What's it saying about not only their behavior, but how our society shapes it? And Renee, I want to go back to you on this one.
Well, I mean, you know, I think this has been such a part of our society for so long. I mean, something you see in the ad is they use a clip from a cartoon that's probably from the 1940s of, you know, the leering wolf, you know, sort of like lurching at a group of women at a table. All of these sorts of scenarios where you have that, you have the men on the street catcalling women. You have in the boardroom where a woman is talking and her boss interrupts her and is like, what she's trying to say, you know, the whole idea of mansplaining. You know, it's covering a lot in an ad that's less than 2 minutes long. And I think, you know, for people who are in those scenarios, for the women in those situations, it's all very, very familiar. I think there are lots of men who might see this and have no idea that either this is what women deal with or this is the way their behavior can affect women. You know, again, it's not a matter of, you know, demeaning masculinity, but it's just saying, men, look, be accountable for your behavior. Think of the way you exist in the world and how that affects other people. You know, I don't know that, you know, I think if someone believes that being a better human being somehow underlines their masculinity, then maybe their masculinity wasn't all that to begin with.
Matt, I wonder if you can respond to that. You know, what about this argument that the ad is doing just that, that it's asking men to be self-reflective, to be accountable? What do you think about that?
The essential value of masculinity is strength. It's necessary to develop strength for a number of reasons. First, to be emotionally whole. But then secondly, later in life, to be able to have the strength to make moral decisions. What you do with the strength, once you have it, you can go good and you can go bad. And we see in the ad some men making bad decisions, doing bad things. Those things should be condemned. And the idea of one man calling out another and saying you shouldn't do that, fantastic. But you need that strength to develop in the first place. And this is why I go back to those two boys fighting in the ad. That's not a destructive thing. For two boys to be developing their emotional strength, their physical strength, it's part and parcel of being a human being to be able to make strong and good decisions later in life.
Chris, you're in the studio
isn't that
with me.
Equating strength and violence? Sorry.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah, actually,
isn't that equating strength
moderate,
and violence?
A moderate amount of violence as a child, as a teenager, is part of how a boy grows up. That's one of the reasons that contact sports are so popular. That is part of how a boy develops. Yes, I do equate the two.
Contact sports are quite different from fighting. Contact sports are, there's a referee there, there's teams that are matched, there's opponents who are matched. Whereas, you know, boys fighting, and then let's just take this up to teen years, that's where, you know, it becomes sort of every man for himself. And the idea that strength is derived from that, I feel, is a bit of a misnomer. I think where strength is derived is, as the teacher called before, and she's fifth grade, but she said finding your words, being able to communicate. I feel strength comes from inside, not from your fists.
All right, let's go to Jocelyn from Salem. Jocelyn, hi.
Hi. I was just calling, and I'm just listening to a lot of the callers calling in, and I just think it's a little interesting that so many of the men calling in are just getting so defensive over the ad, and I think that's part of the problem. I think when you get so defensive, it kind of just shuts down the dialogue completely. I think we have to understand, and I think we have to accept that a lot of men and boys have a lot of these feelings and emotions, and yes, they are different than how men and women kind of probably feel about things, but if we don't deal with those and understand that maybe men and boys have an anger that they just don't know how to express rather than expressing it in a violent way or whatever, we need to, as a society, figure out how to deal with that and let boys find better and more constructive ways to deal with those emotions rather than just instantly getting defensive when we try and even have an open dialogue about it or have an ad about it. So, I don't know. I just think it's interesting how defensive everyone's been getting about it so far.
Jocelyn, thank you so much. Matt, going back to you after this question, do you feel defensive going back to this fight scene between...
I wouldn't say defensive. I would say defend as a verb. And the reason I make the distinction is this ad is an attack. It's an attack on masculinity. It's an attack using bad behavior and using a wrong narrative of how that bad behavior develops. That's why you see such an amazing negative reaction in various parts of the country online. The number of, if you just look at the number of negative comments on YouTube, I'm not talking about the quality of the comments, just the numbers, the negative number of negative comments versus positive comments. It's not men reacting defensively. It's men reacting because they see an attack on human development as a male.
All right. Chris, as a man, do you feel attacked by the ad?
I don't feel attacked by the ad. What I find almost preposterous is the idea of a war on masculinity. there's, I feel like men, of all the groups in society, I feel like men are probably the least attacked. The term that I've seen in a lot of comments is feminazi, which was mind-boggling to me. There's a perception among men, I don't know, you know, men who are out there, I don't know any of them personally, that women or other groups are after their masculinity. For some reason, they want to take it away. I don't see that happening anywhere.
Right. And of course, men statistically own more power in the world than women.
Yes.
They lead more companies. They lead more businesses. They are legislators more than women. We've been talking to Chris Muther, Boston Globe travel writer and columnist. Also with us today was Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist, and Matt McDonald, editor for New Boston Post, a conservative publication. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Maria Garcia. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.